Congratulations again, Mr. Fitzpatrick. Both Mr. Fitzpatrick. First case for argument this morning is FDIC versus Lubbock et al. Mr. Richmond.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Lawrence Richmond. I represent the FDIC, the appellate. This case is here on appeal from a final judgment dismissing the FDIC's contract and tort claims for under the statutes of limitations. We are seeking today reinstatement of those claims and remand for further proceedings. There are three main issues in the case. The first issue, the one I would like to focus upon, is whether federal common law can displace state law in the choice of law question. That issue is undecided in this court, and the courts of appeals are split on that issue. Beyond that, if the state law is displaced, the question is which jurisdiction has the most significant relationships. The third issue being, did the district court properly dismiss the FDIC's claims on a factual finding as to when the FDIC discovered its claims? Now, the federal common law question that we've briefed, as I mentioned, is undecided. Courts are split. We are urging this court to follow the position staked out by the District of Columbia, 2nd, 4th, and 8th Circuits, and that is that you cannot use a federal common law rule without going through an analysis to determine whether there is a significant conflict between the otherwise applicable state law and the federal program or policy. Now, I think the significant points here are that the Erie Doctrine, which creates a presumption of using state law, is not confined to diversity cases. It applies whenever the state law provides the rules of decision, as this court recently said in the Potter-Romanos case. Cases like this one, which are where the federal question is deemed to arise, we think are much closer to diversity cases than they are to a true federal question case. Really, the only reason the case is in federal court is because of that clause deeming it to arise. All of the claims, all of the law, are state law issues. Indeed, even in a federal context, what you think of as a federal context, like bankruptcy law, even there, courts have used the same analysis. The best example of that is the Second Circuit's Gaston and Snow case, upon which we rely heavily. So the bottom line, we submit, should be that there is no automatic resort to federal common law, which is what the district court did. Moving to the analysis, is there a conflict between the state law and any federal program in this case, the answer is no. FIREA, the statute we operate under, says the FDIC gets the longer statute of limitations. Go with the longer statute, and that's exactly what would happen in this case. There's no conflict at all with any federal program. Now, there's been some concerns raised about form shopping, allegedly that we're somehow form shopping in this case. I think form shopping really involves trying to find an inappropriate form. Well, Illinois is not an inappropriate form in this case. There are many, many contacts, as we've detailed in our briefs, between the FDIC's claims and Illinois. Indeed, I think the fact that the district court's call on this issue was so close indicates that Illinois is not an inappropriate form. So this is not a case of form shopping. Beyond that, as several courts, especially the D.C. Circuit and the AI trade case, have said, the policies against federal common law are powerful policies. The Second Circuit in Gaston and Snow said those policies very often, practically always, trump any concerns about form shopping. So I don't think that form shopping or any of those concerns are a basis for using federal common law in this case. And if the federal common law is rejected, the state law is adopted, it's undisputed that the Illinois statute of limitations apply. 10 years for contracts, it is undisputed that our contract claims are timely. If you apply Illinois law, you then have to get on to the question of the discovery rule. And in this case, the district court held that the FDIC had discovered its claims when some Department of Justice attorneys came and interviewed men and Mr. Blumenthal at the FDIC. We think that was an inappropriate holding or finding at this stage of the case. This case was before the court on motions to dismiss. So it's not a time for fact-finding.
Was there sufficient discovery before that it was before the court?
No, Your Honor. The only, we had submitted, the FDIC had submitted an affidavit, but there was no discovery beyond that. There was no anything beyond that. There was no real discovery, no. So Really, it comes down to what, when you read that affidavit, when you read the report of the interview, what does that tell you? And it's our position that the only way to conclude that the FDIC had discovered its claims, or should have discovered its claims, is to draw inferences from that interview. There are many different ways of looking at what that interview might have conveyed. And, of course, once you start drawing inferences, you're in trouble, because you're not supposed to be doing that at a dismissal stage, even at a summary judgment stage. And if you're drawing inferences, those inferences have to be drawn in the FDIC's favor. So we think that was a mistake, and that if you apply the Illinois law, go to the discovery rule, the FDIC did not really discover its claims until Mr. Roderick was indicted in 1997, and the tort claims were filed within 5 years of that time. So we think that even under that analysis, our tort claims were timely.
It doesn't have much to do with the legal questions that you present here, but why did the FDIC wait so long to bring this case, which is pretty sizable fraud claim? And why put yourself in this position where you have to?
I don't have a clear answer for you, Your Honor. I wouldn't have done that if I had known the claim was there. I would have, filed, much more quickly, at least when the criminal matter was concluded. But that's why you have statutes of limitations, and sometimes happens if you file near the end of them, or time goes by, and that's why you've got that time period in there. So,
well, you're not saying that the FDIC looked at all this law and decided that they could hold off?
No, not at all. No,
I waited a long time, and now you're trying to save the case as best you can.
I work for a government agency, and sometimes things move more slowly than they should. And but I think the law we're arguing for here is not some. Illinois is not a jurisdiction that has nothing to do with this case. We think it has everything to do with this case. And all of the events that really matter to our claims occurred in Illinois. So it's not the wrong law to be applying here. I think it's a comfortable fit. And really the idea of using federal common law to displace that is, and going with some kind of an automatic rule on that, I think is a much more troubling notion, and one that this court we urge this court to reject.
Yes, Mr. Fisher, is your view, as I can tell from the reply brief, that Chapman just doesn't command an outcome in this case?
Not at all, Your Honor, because there was a federal statute that dealt with it, and under Kimball and all of the law, if there's a federal statute, you go with it. So it just didn't address the question presented by this case, which is a pure state law case where there is no federal statute that controls. So we just don't really think it has any application at all.
Okay.
Unless there are further questions, I'll come back on the rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Sola? Thank you, Mr. Richard.
May it please the Court. My name is John Sola, and I represent the Appellees, Larry and Janelle Etner. I don't represent any of the other Appellees. In asking this court to affirm the district court's dismissal of the FDIC's claims, I will only address the issues that Mr. Richmond addressed in his argument. The FDIC's first contention is that RTC versus Chapman, this court's holding or statements in RTC versus Chapman don't apply. Well, clearly they do apply. This court couldn't have been more clear when it said when a district court sits pursuant to federal question jurisdiction, it applies federal choice of law rules. That is exactly what Judge Shader did below, and using those rules, he correctly applied the law of the D.C. Circuit as the comparison law for purposes of FIREA. The last thing that Mr. Richmond, counsel for the FDIC, said in response to a question by Judge Fromm was that RTC versus Chapman didn't apply because there was a federal statute that was in place. Well, here there's a federal statute in place. It's FIREA. It governs all claims that the FDIC brought. It established the statute of limitations for the district court to choose, either the 6-year for contract and 3-year for tort claims that FIREA mandates,
or a longer state law. But what FIREA didn't tell the district court, which is a matter left open, was which state's law to use. And there, applying principle from the Supreme Court in O'Melveny and Kimball Foods, the district court properly viewed this as an open issue and viewed it as what law would the federal court, using federal choice of law principles, apply. And as this court, Judge Easterbrook, said in RTC versus Chapman, in O'Melveny and Kimball, the appellate court and the Supreme Court did not view it as what law would a state choose, but what law would a federal court choose. And that's exactly what Judge Shader did here. And then using the balancing test, he decided that this court, or this case, had more significant context to Washington, D.C. than it did to Illinois. Another comment that the FDIC's counsel made just now was about forum shopping. In response to Judge Evans' questions about why they wait so long, well, it may not matter why they wait so long. Maybe maybe that was a choice. Maybe they forgot about the case. But what happened was they clearly looked for a forum in which their otherwise time-barred claims could be brought. And policy, federal policy, should discourage that. There shouldn't be forum shopping. There is no state interest whatsoever to be protected, as the Supreme Court wanted to do in Erie and Claxon, by allowing the FDIC to get the benefit of an Illinois procedural rule. In fact, O'Melveny and Kimball, I submit, foreclosed that.
Well, you don't deny that Illinois had some significant contacts with this case, do you?
They have. I would say, Your Honor, the significant contacts with Illinois are just the fact, the happenstance, that defendants happen to live here. And defendants happen to make some statements or submit some forms that were mailed from here. But the real significance is who controlled the bidding process? The RTC.
Washington, D.C. may have more contacts, but this isn't like they picked Idaho or something.
No, but I was thinking about this. What if Mr. Etner was from Indiana and Mr. Wavik was from Illinois? Or there was multiple defendants from different states? There would be different representations from other places. And that's exactly what proves that the District of Columbia had the most significant contacts with this case. They're the ones who controlled the bidding process. They're the ones who allegedly relied upon the misrepresentations were made. I mean, if they filed this case in Indiana, clearly there would be argument that somebody from Illinois should be protected, or, you know, had an interest in this case, but mostly it's the people in Washington, D.C., the RTC and their successor, the FDIC. Unless your court has more questions about RTC versus Chapman, I'll go on to a couple of the other arguments that the FDIC raised. With respect to Judge Shader's converting this case from a motion to dismiss, at least with respect to the discovery rule, to a motion for summary judgment, this wasn't a hide-the-ball situation. In his August 2nd, 2002 opinion, he clearly said, "I'm converting the discovery rule issue to a motion for summary judgment, and I command the FDIC to submit information pursuant to Rule 56 in the nature of affidavits and what other documents." The FDIC chose to do that, and they submitted the Blumenthal memo, the affidavit, coupled with the Blumenthal memo, squarely shows that the FDIC had reason to believe or should have done some kind of investigation into its claims. As this court has stated in discussing the discovery rule, you can't act like an ostrich. Blumenthal's affidavit is even more than someone just acting like an ostrich. Blumenthal states, "Yeah, I knew about this stuff, but I thought someone else had already started an investigation." And as Judge Shader aptly put it, and I can't say it any better, that equates to somebody not yelling fire because they thought someone else heard the alarm. And that's exactly what the FDIC did in this case. Mr. Blumenthal, who was the director of ethics, was interviewed by the Department of Justice. He was given a hypothetical question that is identical to the facts that are alleged in this lawsuit. And he was put on notice that either A, he had a claim, or B, the FDIC or the RTC should investigate a claim, or C, he should tell someone who has the authority to
investigate the claim. Allowing the FDIC to skirt the discovery rule because someone who had the investigative authority wasn't the person who had the interview would give the government and the FDIC an advantage in every case. They could just turn a blind eye until the police officer or the investigator found out about it. And I can't understand how the day an indictment comes down of another person is the triggering event. With respect to the balancing test, Mr. Richmond didn't really address that, and I'll rest on my papers unless the court has further questions of me.
Apparently not, Mr. Searle.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you. Mr. Richmond?
Just very quickly, I think counsel conceded that Fireria is silent on the critical issue involved here. I think that's what distinguishes Chapman, because there he had a controlling federal statute. The Illinois contacts, I think, are substantial. I think it's wrong to belittle the fact that the papers were executed here on sort of the theory that the fraud can be done here and it's okay, and Illinois doesn't care as long as it's shipped out of state. I don't think that's an appropriate policy. Finally, with Mr. Blumenthal, of course, you only get there if you get into some of the state law issues, get through the federal law. I think if you look closely at that interview report, Mr. Blumenthal was told two facts. Those facts were some unknown person called up and said there was funny business going on, but we don't know who it was, but that was cleared up with certifications. And then he was told that Mr. Etner and Mr. Wabick had some questionable activities with another bank, but they were cleared up by certifications. So what he was told in the interview is no basis at all for thinking that the FDIC had been injured or that Mr. Wabick had been the one to injure them, which are the elements of discovery. So then he was posed a hypothetical. So really what this comes down to is what inferences do you draw from the fact that some Justice Department lawyers show up in your office and pose this hypothetical to you? Yes, it might indicate that, you know, something is going on with Mr. Wabick, but it might also indicate that they're not sure what's going on. They're trying to find out, and they're looking into it. So there are inferences to be drawn, and as soon as you're trying to decide which inference is the one, that's not the judge's job at the motion to dismiss stage. That's for the trier of fact, and that's our central point. You shouldn't be making these kind of fact findings at this point. Beyond that, would due diligence have discovered the claims? Well, the Justice Department has got an investigation going, and I think it's a good chance that if the FDIC had said what's going on, they would have said, please stay out. We'd like to conduct our criminal investigation. It's a secret grand jury proceeding. We'll let you know if an indictment comes down. So I'm not even sure, and it's certainly not clear, that they would have discovered the claims, even Mr. Blumenthal had gone on to do something. So we urge the court to...
Just one question. In response to a question from Judge Bauer about discovery being not sufficient, are you speaking to the time when Judge Shader converted it to a 56 and called for affidavits that you did not have sufficient time, or did you request to do more?
We did not request to do more. I'm not exactly sure if the order specifically said it was converted. I think he said submit some papers that might comply with
right.
Route 56. But
that's a pretty strong indication where the judge might be going.
Right. But yeah. We did not ask for more, but they didn't do anything either. So it's there. I think that we were asked to submit something, we did. So I think to that
you didn't complain about the lack of discovery.
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Richmond. Thank you, Mr. Sherlock. The case is